Rob Roy by Sir Walter Scott. You have requested me, my dear friend, to bestow some of that leisure with which Providence has blessed the decline of my life in registering the hazards and difficulties which attended its commencement. The recollection of those adventures, as you are pleased to term them, has indeed left upon my mind a checkered and varied feeling of pleasure and of pain. Neither is it possible for me to doubt what you have often affirmed, that the incidents which befell me among a people singularly primitive in their government and manners have something interesting and attractive for those who love to hear an old man's stories of a past age. Early in the 18th century, when I, heaven help me, was a youth of some 20 years old, I was summoned suddenly from Bordeaux to attend my father on business of importance. When I dismounted from my post-horse, I hastened to my father's apartment. He was traversing it with an air of composed and steady deliberation, which even my arrival, although an only son unseen for 4 years, was unable to discompose. I threw myself into his arms. He was a kind, though not a fond, father, and the tear twinkled in his dark eye, but it was only for a moment.
"Dubourg writes to me that he is satisfied with you, Frank."
"I am happy, sir."
"But I have less reason to be so," he added, sitting down at his bureau.
"I am sorry, sir."
"Sorry and happy, Frank, are words that on most occasions signify little or nothing. Here is your last letter."
He took it out from a number of others tied up in a parcel of red tape and curiously labelled and filed.
"You advise me," reading from my letter, "that in the most important business of forming a plan and adopting a profession for life, you trust my paternal goodness will hold you entitled to at least a negative voice, that you have insuperable objections to the arrangements which I have proposed to you. There is much more to the same effect, occupying 4 good pages of paper, which a little attention to perspicuity and distinctness of expression might have comprised within as many lines. For, after all, Frank, it amounts but to this, that you will not do as I would have you."
"That I cannot, sir, in the present instance. Not that I will not."
"Words avail very little with me, young man,"
said my father, whose inflexibility always possessed the air of the most perfect calmness and self-possession.
"Can not" may be a more civil phrase than "will not," but the expressions are synonymous where there is no moral impossibility. "But I am not a friend to doing business hastily. We will talk this matter over after dinner. Owen!"
Owen appeared, with the same grave, formal, yet benevolent cast of features which continued to his death to distinguish the head clerk of the great house of Osbaldiston and Tresham.
"Owen," said my father, "you must dine with us today and hear the news Frank has brought us from our friends in Bordeaux."
I shall long remember that dinner party. Deeply affected by feelings of anxiety, not unmingled with displeasure, I was unable to take that active share in the conversation which my father seemed to expect from me, and I too frequently gave unsatisfactory answers to the questions with which he assailed me. At length I took courage to speak, endeavouring that my tone of voice should betray my feelings as little as possible. "I am quite aware, sir, how ill-qualified I am to play the conspicuous part in society you have destined for me, and luckily I am not ambitious of the wealth I might acquire. Mr. Owen would make a much more effective assistant."
"Owen," said my father, "the boy is mad, actually insane. And pray, sir, if I may presume to inquire, having coolly turned me over to Mr. Owen, although I may expect more attention from anyone than from my son, what may your own sage projects be?"
"I should wish, sir," I replied, summoning up my courage, "to travel for 2 or 3 years, should that consist with your pleasure. Otherwise, although late, I would willingly spend the same time at Oxford or Cambridge."
"In the name of common sense, was the like ever heard?"
"Then, sir, if you think my plan of improvement too late, I would willingly return to the Continent."
"You have already spent too much time there to little purpose, Mr. Francis."
"Then I would choose the army, sir,
in preference to any other active line of life. "Choose the devil," answered my father hastily, and then checking himself. "I profess you make me as great a fool as you are yourself. Is he not enough to drive one mad, Owen?"
Poor Owen shook his head and looked down.
"Hark ye, Frank," continued my father, "I'll cut all this matter very short. I was at your age when my father turned me out of doors and settled my legal inheritance on my younger brother. I left Osbaldiston Hall on the back of a broken-down hunter with 10 guineas in my purse. I have never crossed the threshold again, and I never will. I know not, and I care not, if my fox-hunting brother is alive or has broken his neck, but he has children, Frank, and one of them shall be my son if you cross me further in this matter."
I thought at the time there was something unkind in this, and I still think that my father's conduct was injudicious. A more conciliatory treatment would, in all probability, have gained his purpose. As it was, I stood fast, and, as respectfully as I could, declined the proposal he made to me. Perhaps, for who can judge of their own heart, I felt it unmanly to yield on the first summons, and expected further solicitation, as at least a pretext for changing my mind. If so, I was disappointed, for my father only said,
"Well, Frank, you are nearly of age, and as well qualified to judge of what will constitute your own happiness as you ever are like to be, and therefore I say no more. But, as I am not bound to give in to your plans any more than you are compelled to submit to mine, may I ask to know if you have formed any which depend on my assistance?"
I answered, not a little abashed, that being bred to no profession, and having no funds of my own, it was obviously impossible for me to subsist without some allowance from my father, that my wishes were very moderate, and that I hoped my aversion for the profession to which he had designed me would not occasion his altogether withdrawing his paternal support and protection.
"That is to say, you wish to lean on my arm, and yet to walk your own way. That can hardly be, Frank. However, I suppose you mean to obey my directions, so far as they do not cross your own humour."
I was about to speak. "Silence, if you please," he continued. "Supposing this to be the case, you will instantly set out for the north of England to pay your uncle a visit and see the state of his family. I have chosen from among his sons, he has 6, I believe, one who I understand is most worthy to fill the place I intended for you in the counting house, but some further arrangements may be necessary, and for these your presence may be requisite. You shall have further instructions at Osbaldiston Hall, where you will please to remain until you hear from me. Everything will be ready for your departure tomorrow morning."
With these words, my father left the apartment. "What does all this mean, Mr. Owen?" said I to my sympathetic friend, whose countenance wore a cast of the deepest dejection. "You have ruined yourself, Mr. Frank, that's all. When your father talks in that quiet, determined manner, there will be no more change in him than in a fitted account."
And so it proved. For the next morning at 5 o'clock, I found myself on the road to York, mounted on a reasonably good horse, and with 50 guineas in my pocket, travelling, as it would seem, for the purpose of assisting in the adoption of a successor to myself in my father's house and favour, and, for aught I knew, eventually in his fortune also. My mental ruminations, notwithstanding my assumed confidence, were not always of an unchequered nature, and I should have been reduced to rather an uncomfortable state of dullness had it not been for the occasional conversation of strangers who chanced to pass the same way. One evening, one such acquaintance and I were about to grace the board of the ruddy-faced host of the Black Bear in the town of Darlington, the bishopric of Durham, when our landlord informed us, with a sort of apologetic tone, that there was a Scotch gentleman to dine with us. "Let us have his company, by all means," answered my companion, and then, turning to me, he gave vent to the tenor of his own reflections. "I respect the Scotch, sir. I love and honour the nation for their sense of morality. I have been creditably assured, sir, by men on whom I can depend, that there was never known such a thing in Scotland as a highway robbery."
"That's because they have nothing to lose,"
said mine host, with the chuckle of a self-applauding wit.
"No, no, landlord,"
answered a strong, deep voice behind him.
"It's e'en because your English gaugers and supervisors that you have sent down benorth the Tweed have ta'en up the trade of thievery over the heads of the native professors."
"Well said, Mr. Campbell," answered the landlord. "I did not think thou'd been so near us, mon. But thou kens I'm an outspoken Yorkshire tyke, and I'll go markets in the south."
"Even in the ordinar," replied Mr. Campbell, "wise folks buy and sell, and fools are bought and sold."
This was the first time I had heard the Scottish accent, or indeed that I had familiarly met with an individual of the ancient nation by whom it was spoken. There was much more about him that coincided with my previous conceptions. He had the hard features and athletic form said to be peculiar to his country, together with a national intonation and slow, pedantic mode of expression arising from a desire to avoid peculiarities of idiom or dialect. His conversation intimated that he was engaged in the cattle trade, no very dignified professional pursuit. And yet, under these disadvantages, he seemed, as a matter of course, to treat the rest of the company with the cool and condescending politeness which implies a real, or imagined, superiority over those towards whom it is used. Mine host and his Sunday guests, after an effort or two to support their consequence by noise and bold averment, sunk gradually into the authority of Mr. Campbell, who thus fairly possessed himself of the lead in the conversation. So the evening passed, and next day I left the Great Northern Road to turn more westerly in the direction of Osbaldiston Manor, my uncle's seat.